you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. Thank you for listening to the Twilight Histories. Today we have a unique show for you. I gave our Patreon community a word of inspiration, the moon. I asked them to come up with some show ideas inspired by that word. They came up with 20 ideas. I then asked some of our podcasters to pick an idea that they liked and turn it into a mini show. Today, you're going to hear the results. And I have to say, they're pretty cool. The creativity and the production values are intense. First up is Tristan Verboven, the voice behind the Story Engine podcast. He picked an idea from our patron, Steve DeFalco. Here's the original idea. Humanity has set out to colonize the solar system. You reach Enceladus, the moon of Saturn, and land near the geologically active South Pole. The plumes erupting from the geysers are mesmerizing, hypnotic, intelligent. That was Steve DeFalco. Let's see what Tristan Verboven can do with that.
You wake standing.
Enceladus, level 1.
The world generates all around. Filters go up. The surface renders into cracks and crevices. The angle, dimension, and temperature of every shape is calculated on the screen. A few things immediately become apparent based on this data. The surface is extremely cold. Solid ice, 3 or 4 kilometers thick. The primary source of light is a small but bright spot in the sky, casting a translucent radiance as it reflects off the cold, parched surface. It is, however, barely noticeable next to the grayish-brown, gaseous celestial body that dominates the sky. What little black expanse of space lies on the fringes is filled with a hazy ring sliced in halves by a razor stripe that cuts across. The other thing is that your body is not flesh. Your hands move with snake-like agility in an exoskin that covers your entire body, scales constantly flexing with every movement. Ribbed within the membrane is a fine working of intricate metal cagings and hinges, assisting your every motion. It is comfortable and does not betray any sense of the cold vacuum of space that surrounds it. Crouching down to inspect the surface, the suit replicates a familiar Earth gravity. Judging by the acute curvature of the horizon, current gravity must be a mere fraction of it. The skin allows sensation of texture without any effect of the cold. The visor simultaneously reports data on the sample. It takes nothing more than a thought to compel your body forward into the icy expanse. Walking with the same ease as a terrestrial stroll, your feet grip the surface effortlessly, collecting data as they go. In the absence of atmosphere, a mist of tiny ice pellets hovers around, disturbed by the unusual presence of movement. The mist clears at the crest of an enormous crevice. According to the data, it is some 274 meters to the other side, and just as far downward into the dark abyss. The trough extends in each direction farther than can be seen. Slowly, on the other side, the glowing pulse of a beacon appears. The gentle beat is strangely mesmerizing. It's not of this world. What could be of a world so barren and lifeless? Certainly not such a thing. The only way across is to delve deep into the oblivion of the canyon. It's possible to make out the first 10 or 20 meters of descent, but once the ice falls into shadow, it gives off nothing but the light reflected from the pale planet above. But with little more than a thought, the skin once again compels your body forth, and as the ice becomes too steep to stand on, claws emerge from your hands and feet to grip the edge, and a light shines from your forehead to illuminate the way. Before long, the tiny grips are all that keeps your body from tumbling into the black maw. The texture becomes more brittle, harder to grasp, and every moment recording enormous amounts of data into its banks, a stream of details about density, temperature, and angles, helping your eyes and hands find their grip. Looking up, the sky is nothing but a vaporous ooze of the massive planet above, giving almost no more light, bathing the ice in a murky din. Suddenly the skin seizes. This gripping paralysis is accompanied by a sudden surge of unexpected relaxing sensation throughout your body. As an apparatus emerges from behind you, the hardened grip anchors into the ice and shoots a cylinder deep into the wall. In front of your face, it grinds deep with an intense spin. After digging an arm's length in, gently emerges with a shaft of ice, depositing it seamlessly into a case on your back. The grip releases. The descent continues, and while your hands are perfectly visible in the light, your feet are feeling their way into total darkness. This continues for some time, though it is hard to tell how long. Data comes across the screen, revealing a sudden spike in seismic activity. The tremor is too slight to feel, but definitely there. The descent continues nonetheless, and another spike and then another. And that one could be felt. Then, without warning, the entire column of ice begins to slide, and your body falls into a plunge. Without a solid surface or visual bearing, the real gravity kicks in. The slow, blind freefall is disorienting, and the skin releases a series of anchors in all directions to stabilize. The slow plummet ends with your body getting wedged awkwardly into a narrow, icy opening at the bottom of the crevice. The only way to tell up is by the murky mother planet that occupies the entire sky. And from this sky slowly falls the enormous chunks of ice that follow you down, resulting in a heavy mist of ice pellets, shrouding the area in opaque darkness. The impact of the ice creeps a painstaking heap upon your legs, the sheer mass of which is enough to gradually, silently, and agonizingly crush your ankle. At first, the pain shoots through your body, but within a moment, it is replaced by a wave of relief and paralysis.
Damage report. Bone contusion. Displaced fracture in left tibia.
The suit goes to work, first setting the bone, then fusing it, and then finally reinforcing it. Meanwhile, another core sample is taken. By the time the paralysis wears off, your leg is back to normal, stronger even than before, so much so that the pile of ice that crushed it can easily be removed. That has given enough time to gather bearings on your position. Despite the lack of light, the visor has collected a wealth of data on your surroundings. All of the options lead upward towards the far edge of the crevice. The nearest one is as good as any, and the suit compels your body to scale it. But no sooner than the first step up, and another jarring seismic jolt churns below. It is followed by a jet of white powder blasting upwards. Your entire body is being shot into a disorienting spin. Several moments pass as the blur slows down into a discernible turning world. Stabilizers fire and the rotation slows. The icy planet, the mother planet, the rings, the sun, repeating until they stop on the familiar icy surface below. Once the view is perfectly still, the data comes into view. The jets are water with traces of other substances. Your body now hovers at several kilometers altitude, but it is gradually falling. It is now possible to make out the crevice below, part of an intricate network of irregular cracks and scars that riddle the surface. The geyser that just thrust your body into the atmosphere continues a fine mist billowing upwards into space. Truly spectacular. Heat sensors report the water leaving the bottom of the crevice almost boiling, then instantly freezing into pellets. The stabilizers fire. The beacon at the crest of the gash seems to get closer. With nothing else to do, your stare is fixated, until finally your feet find the ice pack with a crunch. The glow is some meters away atop a castle of ice. Its palpitating attraction is now irresistible. Its warmth is overwhelming, and the suit compels your legs to give in to your gaze, and with each step the beacon gets closer, warmer. Finally, atop the castle, you stand before the light. No bigger than a head, it seems so much larger before, so powerful, and the suit shimmers in its glow, its scales erect, magnetized towards it, humming an eerie harmony. And just as you reach your hand towards its gentle relief, the view from the peak reveals itself through the mist. The curve of the horizon is illuminated by the tiny setting sun. The mother planet is creeping slowly to the opposite horizon. And into the distance is a labyrinth of craggy landscape. A trail of beacons descends into an enormous foreboding canyon. Emerging on the other side is massive mountain range into oblivion. Each beacon marking a treacherous ordeal. Each one more forbidding than the last. Each one pulsing in the same tantalizing shimmer, drawing you into its warmth. But the beacon's enticing draw is more than you can bear, and you feel your hand reaching for the heat as it welcomes you in.
Congratulations. Commencing data transfer. Enceladus level 1 complete. Proceed to level 2 when ready.
We'll be right back.
That was Tristan Verboven from the Story Engine podcast, inspired by an idea by our patron, Steve DeFalco. Next up is Devin Field from the Human Circus podcast. He picked an idea by patron Sam McDonald. It goes like this. The moon is a habitable world, like Earth, but having only a sixth of the gravity of Earth means the native life forms evolved in some very strange ways. There's even native intelligent life, though it is only at a Victorian level of technology. As of late, the living moon is having to deal with invaders from another world. Humans. That was Sam McDonald. Okay, here we go. This is the unconquerable podcaster Devin Field.
The funicular winds its way ever outward. Out round the spire, out and up toward the surface. In the flickering light of the crater bug lamps, tunnel openings rush past on the one side, some of them entirely natural caves. On the other side are passageways into the spire itself, from its tapered depths all the way up to its expansive bulk at ground level. Down one of them, you see a figure cycle past, see the distinctive high front wheel of the new machines. You stretch out a little, feel the humming vibration of the rails beneath the carriage, the jarring interjections of tracks in ill repair, the pulsing of silent announcements. Upcoming stops and the proceedings of the Queen's Council, mostly. There's also been another attack. No details yet. They have become so regular. It's astonishing what you can get used to. The vibrations decrease in intensity for a moment, and then cease altogether. Clockwork gears turn, the finely worked metal doors jutter open, and a five of Besants appear, their billowing shapes fluttering in. One Besant, you correct yourself. For once of age, they are only ever in fives. The groups forming in ways you cannot pretend to understand. The bond remaining until death. You may not comprehend it, but you have seen for yourself how the end of one means the end of all. How they would not even recognize the concept of one in that sense. A few others take the steps up into the carriage and find their places. There is another Tennyson, like you, all long-limbed grace, but unlike you, with skin that displays all too clearly the effects of solar winds. No doubt forced to work a job that takes it to the surface, or perhaps not forced. There are those who love it out there and willingly accept the consequences. There is a Babbage, the bat people, some call its kind, speechless and timid. It appeared one year, seemingly out of nowhere, as if conjured up by the stories told in caverns and spires to the lunar young. Or perhaps the stories of another place entirely. You never see any of the bat people's own young. All of them are like gaping infants in large bodies that appear ever to be wasting away. Then, three more new arrivals step aboard. Terrans. There is no mistaking their graceless entrance and inhabitation of the carriage. You follow them with your senses, their unsteady steps from the hatch, their tittering behind plump-faced helmets. They always think you cannot understand them, because they think only in terms of air and sound, have no comprehension of this quiet place and its people. But the colonized have no choice but to understand. Here in this carriage, each expresses it in their own way. You and the other Tennyson radiate discomfort in a way that would be clear to the mind of any lunar life. The five gathers in tighter against itself. The bat person seems to briefly acknowledge the Terrans before returning to its previous state. One of blank acceptance, huddled up in that same peculiar vest and hat, which they all seem to wear. The Terrans make an ungainly lurch toward their places as the funicular shudders into motion and picks up speed. You have seen many of their kind before, but not often in this particular spire, untouched as yet by the war. Not that their soldiers like coming down into the spires very much. You allow yourself the briefest satisfaction, despite what this war has done. They do not like it very much at all. These three are not soldiers, though. At least not in terms of taking arms into enemy territory and taking lives. Or at least, Terrans like these, armored in their innocence, do not seem to think themselves to be soldiers. You have not yet decided if you agree. The funicular's turns become more gentle as the spire widens out and up, and the Terrans settle deeper into seats. They are staring at you now, with their moist little eyes. You make every effort to ignore the rudeness. They don't know that they might as well be tapping you on the shoulder again and again, like a child's game. Except that these children have the military might of that giant in the sky behind them. The arrival of those children had begun as a trickle, but more recently become a torrent. First had come the flag planters. In retrospect, they should have been taken more seriously. Next had been those little trackless trains, wondrous in their own way, but apparently harmless. When the sky carriages came in greater frequency, they were looked to with curiosity and hope. For surely a new age of scientific discovery was about to be born. Your chemists and phenomenists could not wait to question the newcomers. But those who arrived did not provide answers. They had not given. They had taken and they had pried. And then they had killed, indiscriminately, unstoppably, especially up there on the surface. The underground spires had proven more resistant for all the invaders' technological supremacy. So there, they had often favored destruction over occupation. The loss of lives had been catastrophic beyond all proportion to anything in the history of your world. The place the invaders called the moon. Their moon. They still seem not to have learned what you call it. There is so much that they do not care to know. The funicular gives a lurch, and everyone adjusts themselves. You cradle your bag, keeping it from spilling its contents out over the carriage floor. More announcements come humming in around you. The attack sounds like it was a bad one. Everyone stills as they process it. Everyone except the Terrans, who carry on unawares. One showing the other two something that it holds in its hands. Another stop. More passengers shuffling aboard. They see the Terrans and avoid them, moving further back into the rear carriages. You are tempted to follow them, but you will not give the appearance of running away. You will not show fear of the Terrans, for all that they may not even be able to see it. So you sit, paralyzed by anger, through one stop after another. You can see now what it is that the Terrans are looking at. One of those pictures they all carry. Like a daguerreotype, but changeable, shifting, unlike any daguerreotype that you've ever come across. Not for the first time, you wonder what might have been had this all gone differently. You grieve, not just for the lives lost, but for a future lost. A world that will now never have been. You are jolted from your reverie as the carriage shudders around you. You stiffen. That was not the usual roughness of the track. That was something else. You clutch your bag a little tighter. The funicular carries you onward. What was that? The next stop comes without information. Just a few worried-looking passengers who quickly scuttle in and past. At the one after that, the five exits, judging by its movements no less concerned. There has been no news. There has not even been the usual announcement as to the next stop. It comes and goes without communication, as does the one that follows it. And the one after that. Your pocket watch assures you the time is ticking on as it should, but nothing more. You find yourself wondering if there is anyone else left, anyone except you here on the funicular. You look to the bat person, who has all but disappeared down behind its own wings, only that distinctive hat peeking out over the top. The other Tennyson is showing every sign of extreme anxiety, long body coiled up tight to itself. And you realize that yours is the same. And the Terrans at last seem to have absorbed something of the situation, and to be showing some worry. Two have their daguerreotype machines out and are pointing at them in short, rapid gestures. They huddle in tighter, looking toward the front of the carriage as if for an end. A destination. The surface and its stations and safety. Then the news starts coming through, vibrating through the funicular's every surface in cold, unfeeling parcels of information that somehow render their contents more horrifying. An entire crater city is gone. Some terrible weapon has excised it completely, from its sprawling surface structures to its great depths below. The losses are unthinkable. An outrage. A movement off toward the front of the carriage catches your attention. The bat person. It has risen to its feet, drawn its fragile body up to its full height, and unfolded its wings. It stands there for a moment, its gaunt, unreadable face turned toward the Terrans. They, like you, are transfixed, spectators to what is to come. The bat person reaches into its vest pocket, produces a small wheel gun, and fires it twice into the nearest Terran. Blossoms of red bursting from their suit as they crumple slowly to the floor. The second raises its hands as if to fend off the projectiles. But there are two more flashes of light, two bloody eruptions from its chest that arc hypnotically down. The last Terran swims to its feet and stumbles pleadingly towards you, but you fend it off, your superior reach putting you well away from its flailing grasp. Behind it, the bat person is reloading, its delicate hands slipping in and out of its pockets to place more bullets in the wheel, one after another. Fast, but not rushed. At the end, the Terran tries to run, but there is nowhere to go, and besides, it cannot really move quickly on this unfamiliar world. On your world. It caroms gently off the wall and scrapes at a window with its glove, all to no avail. The bat person steps past you, raises the wheel gun, and shoots again, four times. You watch as the body twitches, then is still. An announcement hums through the carriage, last stop before the surface. The bat person pockets its weapon and adjusts its hat. It stands, not quite looking at you, more side on, but you get the sense it's waiting, almost asking for your permission to leave. Waiting to see if you'll make any move to stop it. Gears turn, the doors slide open, and it steps off into the spire, wings folded. You and the other Tennyson exchange a glance and then look to the bodies. As one, you rise, your long arms unfolding to cradle first one Terran, then the next. The funicular is passing a chasm as it makes its final approach to the surface. Together, you crank the windows open and cast the white-suited figures out into the darkness. Watch them twist gracefully down. You watch until you can no longer see them. You crank the windows closed again, and you prepare to disembark.
That was Devin Field from the Human Circus podcast, inspired by a concept by our patron, Sam McDonald. Up next is Josh Hutchins, our in-house Twilight Histories podcaster. He's picked a concept by Steve DeFalco. Wow, Steve, you get two today. Here's Steve's idea. The space race ended with a literal race to the moon. The United States and the Soviet Union ended the Cold War amicably. You arrive 100 years later, in time for the annual race to the moon between the two allies. That was Steve DeFalco. All right, Josh Hutchins, here we go.
Please hurry. The window in this next world is closing soon. And I'm certain you're going to love it. The Twilight Histories technician ushers you to the changing room and begins flipping through the electronic pages of material and muttering under his breath. Okay, here we are at the year 2155. He looks up at you for a moment. Don't look so cross. This won't be the same as what happened to you with the Greek and Chinese space fleets. This is a space race unlike any you've ever seen. In this timeline, the United States and the Soviet Union both reached the moon on the same day, at the same moment. Cosmonauts and astronauts stepping from their respective landing vessels in unison. Many years later, they began an annual race to the moon between the two governments. 2155 marks the 100-year anniversary of the first lunar landing in this timeline. We aren't sure how humanity managed to accomplish this before we did in our own timeline, but maybe you'll figure that out on your own. But hurry, get dressed. We've set you up with an investigative journalist of sorts who goes by the name Gaz. He holds a finger to his ear and looks around with wide eyes. Blast, no time to explain further. He gives you a cursory glance. You look great. Quickly, move to the platform. And one last reminder. This is a race between the space programs of the world's two largest governments and militaries. Don't do anything stupid if you can avoid it. What is your plan for the race today, Major Restov? Psh, he's not going to answer that, dimwit reporter. Why would he? Gaz says. She has both her arms buried in a service port in the side of the ship's interior, with a data visor scrolling text information in teal characters across its surface in front of her eyes. Something electrical inside the compartment arcs with electricity, and Gaz grunts. You open your mouth to say something when she snaps, "Spanner!" You hand her the tool, and she takes it without looking at you, uttering obscenities. Gaz, when you told me you were an investigative reporter, I had a certain type of person in my head, and you aren't it. She leans back to make eye contact with you. I'm investigating, and I intend to report when I'm done. What more do you want? She snatches a tool floating weightless in the air between you, then goes back to her repair work. Besides, If I told you what I was really doing when we first met, would you even be here right now?
Well, no.
This just seems extra...
Extra what?
She says, pausing for a moment and giving you a sideways glance. Extra dangerous. It seems like a lot of risk for not a lot of reward.
Ha! You have no idea what you're talking about.
Fine, you say, shrugging. What are we working on? You ask. She doesn't answer. But the data screen continues.
Fair and respectable competition. This being the anniversary of the first lunar landing means it is even more important that our two great nations demonstrate our cooperation to the world today.
And what do you think about the other ships trying to join the moon race?
The man on the view screen on the wall panel gives a shrug. He scratches at his chest, seemingly absentmindedly, and smiles at the reporter.
Every Russian and American race crew is competent, but we cannot guarantee the competency of other racers. If we were to allow other ships into the race, we would have to inspect their ships as well. This race is not for amateurs.
There's another zap of electricity inside the bulkhead, whatever Gaz is working on. You catch the slight odor of ozone and melting plastic.
Are you burning something?
Look, maybe that Russian guy is right about this race.
This isn't a...
She whips around and puts her face right in yours.
Don't get all weak on me now.
She turns and bolts a metal cover onto the wall access point. I asked you to come along because you said you knew how to operate my targeting systems, not to pester me with questions. She walks to the front of the ship, and you follow, taking your seat in the co-pilot position. She begins pressing buttons. The feeling of weightlessness hits you again, and you stick your magnetic boots to the floor to help ease your stomach. Through the motion in your feet, you feel the docking clamps disengage. We're doing this. So you'd better get your head right.
Gaz, the Americans and Russians have been doing this race for decades now. How many times have you been trying to get in?
This is my third time, she says, punching in coordinates on the screen. The dense glass in front of you quickly sheds its metallic sheen, revealing a dark expanse dotted with stars. In the distance, straight ahead, the moon hovers, half shrouded in black.
I just don't understand why I'm not even allowed to question the wisdom of this. I mean, if it's such a good idea, then you should have no problem telling me.
She grips the steering wheel controls firmly and looks at the floor, stretching her gloved fingers. The two nations have had this race all to themselves for nearly a century. The winner of the race determines lunar policy for the next lunar year. Not everyone on the moon is an American or a Russian. In fact, most people are not. I've lived on the moon nearly my entire life. Fiscal policy, defensive policy, social programs, all being tugged back and forth between the Russians and the Americans, based entirely on this stupid moon race. That's not the basis of a rational government. I intend to see their ascendancy end this time.
By ourselves?
I am not alone. Many others are trying this as well. She turns to look at you. Her straight black hair hangs around her head like a cloud. The ships of the two nations are old technology. They are no match for us.
I get that, Gaz. But don't you have to be allowed into the race to win it?
I mean... We aren't even registered in the race or anything. We're just jumping in like pirates. Yes, you perfectly show the ridiculousness of this race. We are faster. It matters not. We will win this time.
She turns back to her controls and begins pushing buttons.
But why do you need me? Why do you need weapons on this ship if it's just a race?
She giggles. Because there are armed ships that will try to keep us out.
Whoa! Time out. You didn't tell me about that. I thought you said my targeting skills would be useful as a pilot or a navigator.
That is true. They would be useful. However, I will be the pilot. I need your skills as a gunner. You want me to destroy armed gunships? They're unmanned.
Yeah, but we aren't. They'll be shooting at us.
True. And what, pray tell, is your plan for that?
We have a blade of armor and a broadband defensive laser.
And what am I going to be shooting back with?
She leans over and presses some buttons on your display screen. 4 GAU-8A 80mm attack cannons. I took them from a bunch of abandoned A-10 Warthogs in the American airplane boneyard in the desert. They work wonderfully in space. Just go easy on them. We don't have unlimited ammo, and they have a tendency to affect the piloting of the ship with their recoil. This is insane. This is insane. We're gonna die, Gaz. I feel like you're involving me in a crime, and I let you. Why do I let you? She smirks. The news feed cuts to an image of two gray cylindrical spaceships hovering in low Earth orbit. Lines of flashing yellow light stretch out in front of them, leading to the moon.
Thank you, Major Rostov, for taking time to speak with us. We wish him and the Russian crew and the American crew a safe race.
Strap yourself in, Gaz says to you. Her voice seems husky now. You click all the buckles into your 5-point harness and grip your targeting controls firmly with your black gloves.
The race to the moon on the 100th anniversary of the first man landing on the lunar surface. Cruise, on your mark. Get set, go!
You're shoved back into your chair as Gaz slides the throttle levels forward. Bile forms in the rear of your mouth.
Holy jeez, Gaz!
You grunt as vertigo hits you. The ship rolls over and matches its course with two flashing spots at the center of the view screen.
There they are, she says with a predatory tone. What? How are we that close?
I have a shielded hangar.
How do they not know? I said no more pestering with questions. Now shut up and do your job.
Several small objects begin moving into your path like a swarm. They flash lights, and you feel the jolt of the ship.
What was that? You really are dense, aren't you? They're shooting at us. Shoot back.
You move the controls around until one of the small craft is centered in the amber-colored crosshairs, and you squeeze the trigger. The ship seems to veer to the side, and the craft explodes. Then you see other flashes, smoke trails, projectiles.
Ha ha! They did come!
Gaz shouts, maneuvering the ship into the race lanes. A brilliant light flashes from one of the two large ships, causing several control screens of your ship to go dark.
What was that? I thought they were unarmed. So did I.
She slams the controls to the side, forcing into a tight roll. Two rockets slide past the view screen.
They took out our broadband defensive laser. Blast them!
You want me to shoot them? Shoot at the Americans and Russians.
Either you disable them, or they will destroy us.
Your stomach tenses. The air smells like burning electronics, mixed with an uncomfortable sterility. Arcs of electricity frequently interrupt the dark cabin behind your chair. You hear shouts and explosions in your earpiece. Gaz leans over and punches your shoulder.
Shoot them! Now!
You flex your fingers and grip the controls.
That was Josh Hutchins building out a concept by Steve DeFalco. I think you've both got the right stuff. Josh Hutchins has recently completed a very cool project for us. It's our very first Twilight Histories book. Josh and I are going to be launching that next month, so stay tuned. Thank you to everyone who participated in this fun project. That was so much fun. What do you say we do another round? I've asked a group of our fantastic podcasters to participate, and they're standing by, ready for your idea. All you have to do is join us on Patreon. You can join at any tier and you'll be able to add your idea. Your word of inspiration is the ocean. Head on over to Patreon and run a search for the Twilight Histories to add your idea. One idea per patron. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.